Listen if you dare. Now on Radio 4, Phil Tinline finds out what happens when organisations lose their memory in analysis.
Over here, I've got a spreadsheet with all the names of our staff, which section they work in, when they started, and also a column here with their age.
Christopher Nieper runs a clothing company in Derbyshire, and he has a problem.
If we order the chart like this, now you can see that we have just over a fifth of our staff are over the age of 60. Now that means they're likely to retire in the next few years. That's something we cannot ignore. They will retire at some point, and we must find a way of handing those skills from them to the next generation before they're gone.
This is a problem facing organisations up and down the country, large and small. The job for life is gone, and with it so are the uncosted benefits of knowledge and experience. Britons today stay in the same job for less time than workers in much of Europe, and as the economy improves, that churn rate increases. Young workers move jobs much more frequently than equivalent older workers ever did. Short-term contracts and outsourcing reduce the appetite for learning company or product history. And when job losses land, even more knowledge is lost.
There's so many styles here and different ways of making things. In my brain there's an awful lot of information. It's on paper, it's on the computer, and it's in our heads.
And yet each time someone leaves their employer, or even a department, they take with them a chunk of the institutional memory. And how then do you run complex systems, see through long-term projects, or avoid past mistakes? In this programme, I want to examine why this is happening. Is it just a question of money, or does the ideology that change is good play a part too? And is there an appetite to cure the invisible blight that is corporate amnesia? In 2012, one particular institution found that, as city firms poached its bright young employees, its turnover of staff was getting eye-wateringly high, 28% a year, in fact, faster, apparently, than McDonald's. And for Her Majesty's Treasury, after its experiences during the financial crisis, this was rather scary. Outgoing Permanent Secretary Sir Nicholas McPherson.
Our basic business model depends on having a lot of young people who are very enthusiastic. But the one thing they tend to miss out on is, I guess, what is known in the trade as folk memory. That became very clear to me and to Alistair Darling during the course of the crisis, that when the crisis struck in 2008-2009, the vast majority of Treasury staff had never been through even a recession, let alone a banking crisis.
So when 2008 happens, what was the fear?
You know, generally the British economy grows, and then something bad happens. And the risk, and it's in the nature of all booms, at the top of the boom, everybody's always telling you this time it's different. And the important role of the Treasury is to understand why this time isn't different. So I think my view of trying to, in a sense, harness history is to understand that bad things will always happen. You've got to be ready for them. And you've got to learn lessons.
Is there a specific example where a lack of institutional memory either led to a poor decision or delayed the making of a good one?
Oh, I think the run on the Northern Rock was a good example of that. I mean, we hadn't had a run on a bank really since before the First World War. There was no one alive who really could conceptualise that. And, you know, there are really good books written about banking crises, and I guess if we'd all read those, maybe we could have acted more quickly.
Traditionally, government departments have had a very Whitehall way of preserving and passing on institutional memory. Not that long ago, a keen young civil servant could spend a burnished autumn afternoon getting lost in Victorian economic reports in the hallows of the Treasury Library. But now, it's gone. Meanwhile, cuts have eaten away at the preservation of civil service history. So how can Whitehall avoid corporate amnesia in these circumstances? Sir Nicholas and his senior colleagues at the Treasury turned to King's College, University of London, and in particular to Dr. John Davis of the College's Policy Institute. So how are he and his team helping the Treasury with its memory?
It's basically a three-sided approach here. First of all, public events. The first was a public lecture by the Permanent Secretary to the Treasury about why the Treasury backed the Union during the referendum debate. And what the Treasury's doing there is putting on record its side of very recent, very important economic history. Secondly, we've got the research. So we've got one PhD underway at the moment on the Treasury under Alistair Darling. And thirdly is a postgraduate course run at King's. It's entitled The Treasury and Economic History since 1945. We had about 15 students in the class, of which four were serving Treasury officials. And what we do there is to draw through from 1945 all the way to the present the ups and downs, the trials and tribulations of the Treasury's past, which is nothing if not exciting.
So I'm a young Treasury official. I come into the room. What happens?
What happens is that the panel sits along one side, any visiting professors who are keen to be there, and one or two guests. We were very lucky. People like Lord Terry Burns, Permanent Secretary in the 90s, came and joined us. David Willetts, who'd been a Treasury official. Lord Nigel Lawson, talking about the role of Chancellor. We had Alistair Darling come. Then we had Sir Danny Alexander come along. Ed Balls, as you can imagine, both of them not always on the same page. We have Stato Pisani, Mario Pisani from the Treasury, who delivers the graphs and the stats. Sir Nick McPherson usually gives a tour de raison from his point of view.
I think my conclusion is that about once every 15 years the Treasury is hit by disaster. If you work in the Treasury, you spend your whole life trying to climb out of some abyss, only to find yourself going back into it. And actually being prepared for that, knowing what the important issues are really important. Because actually the problems always come around. It's the same old problems.
Same old problems, same old solutions? But there's a risk here, fighting the previous battle, missing what makes a problem new. In a volatile, fast-changing world, is the past really all that useful a guide to the future? To some, institutional memory is not the solution to our problem, it is the problem.
Institutional memory is partly culture. We create culture in any society by looking at what we share from the past, often deifying or honouring it. Inevitably, that means we tend to be trapped into backward-looking patterns.
In her new book, The Silo Effect, the financial journalist Gillian Tett issues a different kind of warning. She argues that institutions allow themselves to become shaped by the past at their peril, even if that past was full of success.
You can see that with, say, Sony, which at the turn of the century thought it was fantastically innovative, creative and smart and very successful because it had had this very impactful cult product, the Walkman. The problem was that it got trapped into the patterns of the past to try and protect the Walkman success, and it didn't really move fast enough to embrace a digital revolution. Steve Jobs at Apple is one of the few leaders who's actively said, OK, wherever we've been successful in the past, we have to basically stop, pause, smash that part for the future, and recognise that we keep moving. When he was running Apple, he had a rule that the company would never make more than 6 products, which meant that if it had a brilliant new idea, it had to kill something from the past. The tragedy of Sony was that every time a new product cropped up at Sony, it didn't kill anything from the past, and the number of products just kept rising and rising and rising until it became a very messy conglomerate behemoth that just didn't work anymore.
Sony's stuck-on-repeat executives meant well, at least. But might overstrong institutional memory conceal an ulterior motive? In the 1960s, a young BBC producer called Anthony Jay became fascinated by the problem of managing large organisations. He left to become a writer and an advocate of public choice theory, which argues that public service is just an alibi for ruthless institutional self-interest. He and his co-writer Jonathan Lynn set to work on a TV sitcom which dramatises this idea, which is how they created the embodiment of a certain kind of institutional memory. Sir Humphrey Appleby.
But comprehensive education was an experiment. Surely it ought to be validated.
Yes, of course, but not invalidated.
In this episode of Yes, Prime Minister, the National Education Service, Sir Humphrey lectures his underling, Bernard, on the real reason for the creation of comprehensives.
But if it was introduced to improve educational standards...
What effort gave you that idea?
You mean it was to get rid of class distinction?
Precisely.
So that all children...
Children? Who remembers
mention children.
But I just
the
thought...
Department of Education never mentions children. No, 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 Bernard. It was to get rid of class distinction in the teaching profession. Improve the living standard of teachers, not the educational standard of children. Bring the NUT teachers in the primary...
And why is Sir Humphrey taking time out to teach his underling the secret history of the civil service? To drive home his lesson, the Prime Minister's reforms must be stopped, the cosy status quo must be preserved. But we shouldn't let Anthony Jay's caricature distract us from the ways that institutional memory can be useful to an organisation. So how do you tell good institutional memory from the bad Sir Humphrey version? To do that, we need to zone in on a subtle but crucial distinction. An institution can look to its memory for two very different things. It can help foster a sense of loyalty, what's often called corporate culture. This is what Sir Humphrey is good at. And this can be helpful, but it can also produce a siege mentality. The other thing institutional memory can do is less romantic, but more practical. It's about avoiding repeating mistakes. David Kneeper is a mail-order clothing manufacturer in Alfreton in Derbyshire. Christopher Kneeper is its chief executive.
One example of where an institutional memory has perhaps saved us, I saw this morning, in fact, in the cutting room. Now, the cutting room is where we get our rolls of fabric and we lay them out on a table and we cut out the pieces that are going to make the garment. Now, sometimes those rolls of fabric can be very tightly wound. And if they're tightly wound, then the fabric is slightly stretched. So when you lay the fabric out and you cut out the piece, it then shrinks and it doesn't fit. And this morning, the staff had remembered that this had happened from the same supplier, the same type of knitted fabric in the past, and they realised that this would happen again. They had then pulled the fabric off and allowed it to relax and rest overnight so that the next day they could lay that fabric up and it wouldn't stretch.
On a big, bright, open shop floor, around 70 workers sit at their sewing machines. Two of them told me how this kind of practical memory is passed on.
I'm Linda Wilson and I've worked here 17 years.
I'm Shani Banner and I've worked here for 6 months.
And Shani, when you first came here,
yeah,
did you feel able to ask people questions about
yes.
how things work?
I think everyone here is quite friendly and no matter what you're stuck with, you can ask anybody anything really.
And so Linda, you and other people who've been here for 17 years or maybe even more than 17 years, in a way you're kind of the memory of the company, right?
Yes, I know an awful lot. I probably know too much. You've got to think I started years ago training like Shani did to progress into garments and everything. And then also I've watched and timed an awful lot of girls, so it's nice to be able to pass that on.
This might all seem obvious, but it doesn't just happen. All that information could easily stay in the heads of Linda and other long-serving workers. Christopher Kneeper says you have to take specific steps to ensure that people share what they know.
When you reach retirement age, instead of stopping suddenly, you could gradually reduce your hours. Instead of doing 5 days a week, you might reduce to 4 or 3 or take Fridays off. And as that allows you to phase your retirement, it allows you to gradually build up another retired lifestyle while still benefiting the business and benefiting your former colleagues with your experience.
And so you give people this more phased, gradual retirement, but how do you actually make sure that they pass those skills and experiences on?
Well, we have to set time aside and allow them to spend an hour a day or full time in a training school, or ask them to coach or mentor and sit alongside somebody in order to make sure that that is possible. Local knowledge in a business like this is not written down. We have no manual about how to sew, how to do customer service, how to pack a parcel, how to design. That knowledge of how to do it is within the combined years and knowledge and experience of its people. That local knowledge is something which can't be measured on a balance sheet.
On the shop floor where the staff are doing piecework, transferring that local knowledge also requires a hard-headed incentive. Everybody in here is being paid by the garment that they make.
Yes, they are.
So you might think that if they're going to be interrupted by a young member of staff with a question, they might say, no, leave me alone, I've got to get on with this because I'll get paid less if I talk to you. How do you foster an atmosphere where they don't say that, they stop when they answer the question?
They'll stop and answer the question and they'll help and they will be paid for it.
So on the one hand, we have the kind of institutional memory offered by Sir Humphrey, great for creating a cohesive culture, but a barrier to fresh ideas. And on the other, the kind offered by Linda Wilson. You can build a corporate culture in various ways. The distinctive benefit of institutional memory is Linda's practical version, particularly in helping to avoid repeating mistakes. So why does this work at David Nieper? It strikes me that one important part of this memory transfer is having a lot of people who've been there a while, but without too much of a hierarchy. In other organisations, you might find an ever-changing parade of managers looking warily at someone like Linda. But instead, her experience is taken seriously, and she's been given responsibility on that basis. She's not been whisked away from the shop floor into distant management offices, nor is she feared as a rebel in waiting, so she can answer Sharni's questions. But how do you prevent corporate amnesia in an irreducibly hierarchical, high-stakes profession where questioning your seniors, admitting you don't know, is scary, like, say, looking after nuclear weapons? A few years ago, David Jarvis ended a 36-year career in the Royal Navy, largely focused on the nuclear deterrent. And towards the end of his career, guess what he noticed?
People like me, when we started in the nuclear deterrent business, we really did it for life, and that doesn't happen in the same way anymore. And so you look over your shoulder and you say, well, who's going to replace me? Who's going to do what I did? And it's hard to identify them.
One of that new generation is Andrea Berger, an expert on nuclear non-proliferation. Her age group's attitude to work is strikingly different from Jarvis's.
I think this generation particularly values variety. So I'm 27, and at this stage in my career, I've had 5 employers. The phrase now, time to move, exists in a very big way. So it's a very different challenge keeping people in a particular field.
How do you get people to understand these issues and get them engaged so that in the future, as a country, we don't make the wrong decisions or make decisions with not enough information? And from a military point of view, you've got enough people that understand what they're doing.
And there's another problem.
In the nuclear field, we have the particular challenge of having very long timelines. On the civil side, for example, Hinkley Point, the nuclear power station that's planned when we actually do get to building and then seeing through its life will be 60 years. The military side of the nuclear picture, that's a similar timeline. Over that period, we have to make sure that we have a group of people contemplating why decisions made 20 years ago, 30 years ago, were made in the way that they were.
So to tackle the collective memory problem this raises, along with the generation gap in nuclear deterrent expertise left by the end of the Cold War, Jarvis set up a regular forum called the Project on Nuclear Issues, known as PONY. PONY brings together his fellow 60-something nuclear lifers with the 20-somethings whose fingers will take their place on the buttons and consoles. To get a conversation going across the seniority divide, PONY has tried some rather left-field stratagems.
We ran a play which brought up the topic of the letter of last resort, which is the letter held on board the submarine that the Prime Minister's written, and it's opened by the commanding officer of the submarine in the event that there's no further communication with the UK because of the advent of a big nuclear war in exchange, so that he doesn't have to make the decision himself over what he's going to do with this boatload of nuclear weapons that he's looking after. We actually then had 2 ex-SSBN commanding officers who would have been the people responsible for opening the envelope and following those instructions. They were able to actually give really good answers to the people in the audience who otherwise wouldn't have got the full picture.
It's always extremely intimidating to walk into a room with 150 people and, you know, some of them are very senior and be asked to challenge the views that are being presented to you.
David Jarvis recently made a point of handing over the reins of PONY to Andrea Berger, as if to underline the idea that this should be a two-way exchange between the generations.
We were in the US, we do annual exchanges with our US counterparts, and one of the speakers was a young lady who was working on a particular technology that had applications in the non-proliferation field. And she gave her presentation, and then a very, very senior former official politely disagreed with some of the points that she made. And she paused and she said, "Sir, I'm sorry, but I think you're entirely wrong," and gave her reasons for this. And he turned around and said, "You know what? You're absolutely right." And that was, I think, one of those perfect cases where the next generation challenging some of the ideas of a previous generation can really have value.
So for knowledge to be transferred, those at the top of a hierarchy need to be humble, at least for a few hours. All the institutions we've looked at so far share a certain amount of continuity. But since the 1970s, a newer model of organisation has developed. Think of Gillian Tett's distinction between Apple and Sony. Companies like Sony were huge, sprawling beasts which hugged their organisation men and women close, trading security for loyalty. But Silicon Valley helped to pioneer a very different approach, all short transactional contracts and a love of constant change. If the old ideal was the giant corporation, today it's the startup. And for organisations that follow this future-focused creed, corporate amnesia is part of the model, sometimes even a badge of honour. Margaret Heffernan, ex-CEO, expert on how organisations work, and author of Willful Blindness.
To preserve institutional memory, you have to encode it in the first place. That means that people have to be prepared to put it where somebody's going to find it. When you have a highly casualized labor force, why would I do that? That knowledge is my power. I put it in my briefcase and I carry it from worksite to worksite, and that's how I ensure my livelihood. As you casualize the labor force, my incentive to help you is fundamentally reduced. Why would I help you? There's nothing in it for me.
But Heffernan argues that in high-risk sectors, this failure to generate institutional memory can be disastrous. In 2005, at BP's Texas City refinery, failures of communication and oversight were among the causes of a geyser-like leak of flammable liquid and an explosion that caused 180 injuries and 15 deaths. And then, 5 years later, there was another explosion on the company's Deepwater Horizon oil rig.
What's really horrifying about this is that when you then go forward to Deepwater Horizon, you find very many of the same causes. One is that as you start casualizing labor, you're using fewer people to do more. So there's a real issue about how much they can remember themselves anyway. And you're using people who may have a very tenuous connection to the organization itself and may be quite unclear as to what they are and are not responsible for. When the accident then happened, nobody did very much to encode the memory. Most of the people involved were gone. The contractors who had died were forgotten about. They didn't work for BP. And their supervisor, who worked for the contracting firm, wanted to memorialize them in order that this not be forgotten. He persuaded his bosses to put a stone up with a tree. There are no names on that stone. There is no date. There is no information about the accident itself. So this is not just institutional amnesia. This is almost a determination not to understand or remember the mistakes that were made.
Not to literally etch it into the memory.
That's right.
Surely they have every incentive to remember why that happened.
I think it's important to recognize that in most very competitive organizations, you are rewarded for success and you typically are punished for failure. So there is absolutely no incentive to remember where I went wrong or indeed to have very much open discussion about where we went wrong.
So one danger is organisations simply don't see memory as important, or even see it as a burden, a barrier to future success. For businesses focused on boosting the bottom line by outsourcing to contractors and freelancers wherever possible, the idea that corporate amnesia is a problem is a fundamental challenge. But even in organisations that cherish institutional memory, there's a subtler risk. That they only remember things that are in harmony with the organisation's worldview and not the jarring, dissonant memories of past mistakes. Outgoing Permanent Secretary Sir Nicholas McPherson.
I think the capacity of people to misremember is extraordinary. And it comes back to my point about booms. The point about booms is at the top of the boom, everybody is always convinced this time it is different, and it's different for very good reasons.
But to tackle this subtler kind of institutional amnesia, as the Treasury has done, demands nerve. If an organisation's leaders will take a leap of faith and be open about past problems, that may give the rest of the organisation confidence to do the same, so everyone can learn from mistakes. And Sir Nicholas argues that doing this through an external body, like King's College, is a good way to stress test the orthodoxies.
The Treasury will always have a slight tendency to want to think that its version of history is the right one. I think you need some external challenge from professional historians who have a framework and a toolkit to look at this in a dispassionate way.
So there are signs that corporate memory is being given its due in the face of the continued enthusiasm for flux and change. Since the banking crisis, politicians across the spectrum have begun to reassert the value of institutions. Former chair of the Public Accounts Committee, Dame Margaret Hodge, has recently called for civil servants to see government commission projects through to a close. As far back as 2000, the Harvard Business Review was urging change-drunk organisations to appoint a chief memory officer. In 2008, American Express began a scheme very similar to David Nieper's to get their older employees to pass on skills through phased retirement and mentoring. It's a shift that Margaret Heffernan has also noticed.
Well, I think there's a real sea change going on in organizational life, which is there's a recognition that whereas in the past we tended to manage people rather like widgets, and we thought, you know, you just plug them in and plug them out when as needed, and we used to think that we wanted maximum efficiency, which was using the most expensive people for the shortest amount of time possible, what we've discovered is that when you start treating the human side of work, which is creative work, innovative work, caring work, that way, you get rather low-grade, miserable results.
And what about the public sector? Are there other signs of interest in King's College's relationship with the Treasury? John Davis.
We've just recently agreed that we will take the Treasury model and we'll build a new course called Number 10 Downing Street and the History of the British Prime Minister since 1945, which will go live this autumn, and we'll see some of the classes actually take place in Number 10.
So perhaps there is a growing recognition that corporate amnesia deserves our attention. In old school organisations, that will mean separating out useful institutional memory from ideology, vested interests and inertia. But if your business model depends on casual contracts and constant movement, it will mean questioning your basic ideology. Startups are great, but only if they don't stop. And if they don't stop, they will develop a past. And, like any other organisation, they will have a better future if they work out which elements of that past are worth remembering. It's just better to rely on the Lindas of the world than the Sir Humphreys to help work out what those are.
Is there a question you've been meaning to ask Linda but you haven't got around to asking her yet?
Johnny, dear, ask her anything. She's young and forthcoming, and I like it like that. Some people will sow it wrong rather than ask. So what we always say is better to ask. Ask 20 times. We don't think you're thick, because it takes twice as long to unpick it as it does sew it. So we say, ask. If you're not sure, ask.
Elizabeth I's fascination with the Orient.
The Queen and her advisers determined to reach out beyond Europe to the Islamic powers in the hope of forging a new alliance against their common enemy, Catholic Spain.
Shedding new light on Tudor England's relationship with the Muslim world.
As early as the 1550s, Englishmen were doing business in Muslim countries as far apart as Morocco and Syria.
Derek Jacobi reads This Orient Isle by Jerry Broughton, next Monday to Friday morning at 9:45, and then available on the BBC Radio 4 website.
BBC News at 9 o'clock.